Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Laveau. Sometimes words do matter. NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg says Ukraine may have to compromise with Russia. What that compromise might be is left unanswered. Nonetheless, it is an acknowledgement NATO's proxy war on Russia is ending in failure. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Pascal Lotas, in Kyoto. He's an associate professor at Kyoto University. In Montreal, we have Matthew Arendt. He is a senior fellow at the American University of Moscow and director of the Rising Tide Foundation of Canada. And here in Moscow, we have Pierre-Emmanuel Thoman. He is a lecturer at Lyon University. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Pascal, let me go to you in Kyoto because you're staying up late. I usually say you got up early. You're staying up late to do this program. You know, Stoltenberg is a very interesting creature to observe. He's obviously just a mouthpiece for the alliance, probably on speed dial to Washington. But he does come out with these things that we should pay attention to, that Ukraine is going to have to make some compromises. Is this an off-ramp for NATO as it approaches its 75th anniversary with not much to be proud of? Pascal.
Well, I would hope that NATO finally understands that an off-ramp is needed now that it has seen basically all of its equipment destroyed by Russia in Ukraine and the Ukrainians little by little losing the ability to fight this war because they're running out of men, right? Without external intervention in the form of boots on the ground, which actually the French and the British are now working on, but without that, there is just no realistic scenario anymore, even to drag out the war. I mean, in Europe, all the talk is that this is a stalemate. But even that is a lie, right? It's not a stalemate. Russia is now clearly in the advantage and can push on. So it seems to me that realism seeps through and NATO understands that an off-ramp is needed. And this is the first kind of signs, maybe, that they are willing to consider it.
Well, Matthew, The argument that we are hearing now is that, and it's been for the last 6 months, more aid is necessary to give the Ukrainians a better advantage at the negotiating table. But Matthew, if you think about it, the more money is sent to Ukraine and material, the less territory they control. Ukraine gets smaller and smaller with more and more money being sent. Can't they see this as a causality issue here, Matthew?
It's difficult to say what they can or cannot see, I have to admit, when we're dealing with these types of technocrats who are so removed from the battlefield or any plane of reality and are so used to being conditioned by game theory models and think tanks without any attachment to reality. So when they come up with an assessment, it's always a little strange to try to get into their shoes vicariously, but I think you're correct. There has been an embarrassing over 2 years lack of any type of progress, and just the reverse has happened. The more money is pouring into the cauldron, the less result has tended to be the outcome. And even the IMF has had to make demonstrations that the data cannot be fudged that much or any more. It's very difficult, as much as the IMF normally fudges data, and has demonstrated that unlike the forecast that Russia would be destroyed by this time much earlier on, they were supposed to be economically destroyed. The IMF recent reports has had to admit that they've bypassed Germany as far as becoming the world's fifth largest economy, the most powerful economy in all of Europe. They've only benefited in many ways by virtue of what has been done sanction-wise and everything else. And the war is just one aspect of the failure of planning by these technocrats. So, yeah, while it's difficult, I do think that there is, like the previous speaker said, some bending to reality currently.
Well, Pierre-Emmanuel here in Moscow. What's really quite curious is that, you know, we have someone like Stoltenberg saying that Ukraine may have to compromise. People like Stoltenberg and the rest of them, they always forget the other party in the conflict, Russia. Maybe Russia doesn't want to compromise. Have they considered that, Pierre-Emmanuel?
Of course not. They know they should consider, but it's their narrative, and the narrative of starting to think about compromising is because they know they are going to lose more and more with time. Russia is gaining more ground, and they try to hide this strategic disaster. And this is the time where they, from their point of view, NATO has to consider to compromise, to stop for Russians to advance and to try to save the rest of Ukraine. But actually, Russia has not the same interest. Russia wants to achieve its full objective, which is to obtain neutralization of Ukraine, but also that Ukraine regime is not a threat anymore to Russia. So it's much more, and the more we wait, the more the sort of compromise will be at a higher cost for Ukraine and the West.
Well, you know, Pascal, one of the difficult things in trying to understand this conflict, if you look at both sides, the two sides are speaking in very different languages and have different ways of understanding it and how it came about. What I'm getting at here is that the Russians always talk about their security. The Europeans and the Americans talk about their so-called values. That's why we're not getting anywhere. Pascal.
Yeah, Russia has made it pretty clear what this war is about for them. And the fact that on social media and in programs like these, this message has been clearly understood and has been discussed for 2 years. The fact that also Emmanuel said, we know that this is about neutralizing Ukraine as a threat and making sure that Russia will be safe, is a very different approach. And this must be heard. I mean, but public media in Europe and in the US says is a completely different thing. It's propaganda. The propaganda is on a different level, and it is still on a different level, but we now see that the people in power actually do understand that what they publicly say and how they actually interpret Russia are not necessarily the same. So this is the best chance that we have, that actually, you know, the people who are responsible for the diplomats and also the military people will start talking sense into the politicians in Europe, telling them, look, at some point we need to actually discuss with the Russians what they want, because they are winning, or they won. Although winning Ukraine is something, you know, this could get much worse.
Pascal, you know, right in December of 2021, before the start of the conflict and the February after, the Russians told the world, telegraphed the whole world what they wanted. It's exactly what they want today. Nothing has really changed. They want security, okay? They want a neutral Ukraine, and they don't want a NATO moving eastward. Those are still the same things. Let me move over to Matthew here. The undertaker of the West, Tony Blinken, two news cycles ago, was standing next to the Ukrainian foreign minister saying, Ukraine will be part of NATO. We haven't gotten much progress here, have we, Matthew?
No, yeah, all that needs to happen is Russia needs to be defeated, and then Ukraine's going to become part of NATO. That's easy, because obviously the second that Ukraine is part of NATO, that's World War III, because there's a lot of obviously powerful interests itching to invoke the Article 5 Collective Security Pact. So that's not something that will happen directly unless you really do want an all-out thermonuclear war, which I don't think that they're that insane. So I don't think that there's a lot behind those words.
Yeah, but Matthew, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're absolutely right. The in lieu of saying something else, they don't have in lieu of something else. They're just saying, yeah. And of course, you know, there's no timetable, there are no conditions. You just will be. You eventually will be. I mean, if I were the Ukrainian side, I would say we need to negotiate the end of this thing here, because you can't trust these Western partners. I'm sorry, Matthew, keep going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But then you have like, what's his name, Alexander Pavlyuk, who is the land forces commander, saying that all citizens must be prepared to fight and thus implicitly die. And they're throwing out people, paraplegics, people who are mentally... you got a lot of people just being thrown as cannon fodder right now, and they're doubling down in Ukraine on the fact that the gospel from 2 years ago is somehow still applicable, and it's certainly not. The reality is completely showing a different picture, and they're not able to conform to it. So I don't know, with Blinken, why he chose to say that, it's just that they're incapable of shifting away properly from their narrative.
That's right. There's only one gear. These people have only one gear. Up here, Emmanuel, what is interesting with the French proposal, I'm not really sure what Macron really means. French soldiers, NATO soldiers. Is that a bluff?
It is a bluff, and I think a narrative mistake as well. Because actually, you have to understand the context. There are European elections in the European Parliament. And the opposition party, like Le Pen party, is far ahead of the party of Emmanuel Macron. And the party of Emmanuel Macron choose for their narrative to push the fact that they are on the side of Ukraine, of freedom, of democracy against the evil Russia, and to accuse the Le Pen party to be a promoter of Russian objectives and to be a Putin agent. This is totally ridiculous. And in the campaign, you can notice the French people don't suck this narrative. They want to vote more and more for National Front. So this is a total narrative failure. And at the same time, also, Emmanuel Macron wanted to make France the leader of the EU, and by supporting Ukraine against Russia to take advantage of, in an opportunistic way, of this situation, and to be the leader in competition with Germany, because France was always in competition with Germany to lead the European project. And you could notice that nobody in EU wants this to be told anything and to be led by Emmanuel Macron, and especially to put troops on the ground against Russia, which will go to a frontal war. And I can tell you that many experts on military, they know it's not possible. It will be a disaster. So it has been a mistake in terms of narrative and also geopolitical thinking.
All right, hold on to that thought there. We have to go to a hard break, gentlemen. And after that hard break, we're going to continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Pascal in Kyoto. I think one thing, if we look over the last 2 years, a few things I think we could all agree on. This is an elite war. Pierre Emmanuel was telling us about how French people feel about it. This is an elite war. They expected Russia would collapse instantly. You know, the sanctions would the ruble would become rubble and all of these types of things. But the only thing they seem to have in common right now is that they don't know how to win because they've lost. So their alternative is just to keep it going. That's what they're doing. Just keep it going. Pascal.
I mean, you earlier said that there is no timeline, but there actually is. And that's November of this year, because that's the big election in the United States. And it is, to me, relatively clear that all that the Democrats in the U.S. are trying to do is to keep it going until beyond the election, when either Joe Biden is safe in the saddle for another 4 years and you can, like, you know, can let it taper out, whatever it is, or Donald Trump wins and you can pin it on him. So really, like, for the Americans at this point is to have it going for another half a year without Ukraine collapsing. For reputational purposes. For the Europeans, it's a completely different game. The Europeans, as you said, they hung themselves in their own words, and that's why we see Macron trying to one-up the game and even maybe go further than what NATO would be willing to do on their own. But this is such a risky gamble, like, not only because it could land us in World War III, but also if it backfires, you know, he loses all credibility in Europe. So the Europeans at the moment go from a bad place to a worse place, yep, out of their own miscalculations.
That's so well put. Matthew, you know, the adage in politics, never let a crisis go to waste. I think that's exactly what European leaders are thinking, or at least Brussels, is that this is a catastrophe. So let's take advantage of it. Let's pursue greater federalization. Let's allow Brussels to start directly taxing the individual citizens of the EU. Not nation states, but Brussels gets to do it. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think there's a big competition in Europe who's going to be harder on the Russians, because this is an opportunity to transform Europe in a way that voters will have no say in whatsoever. Matthew.
Well, the destruction of any type of legitimate democracy in Europe has been a long time coming, and has been partly the manifestation of the sorts of ideas we had originally seen already a century ago emerge out of the mind of people like Kudenhove Kalergi with his pan-Europa fascist movement that had a variety of hyper-fascists like Hjalmar Schacht, many circles around Benito Mussolini. Many of the most hardcore eugenicists, globalists, were all circulating around Kudenhove Kalergi's idea of creating a United States of Europe, which ended up even adopting the outline that he himself designed with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Beethoven would not be happy with that as the anthem. And ever since World War II ended, there has been an immediate effort to try to repurpose and put back into play. But Churchill was a big follower. Leo Amery's kid, Julian, and many others were all advocates, including the head of the British fascist party himself, Oswald Mosley, was a big promoter of this thing. And this became increasingly a federalized structure that would have more power as far as an unelected bureaucracy above those elected components of the nation. And the Lisbon Treaty was just a more recent example of this thing advancing forward in opposition to the actual democratic will of the people of Europe, who didn't want this. They voted no, and it was still forced down the throats of the Irish and others. And so I think you're right. This crisis is being used to advance a more dictatorial downshift of this whole New World Order gambit.
Yeah, but if you don't fall in line, like Hungary or Slovakia, you will pay the consequences, Ursula von der Leyen said. We have the tools, okay, very famously. Pierre-Emmanuel, I mean, what does Europe get out of supporting this war? I mean, I see no upside whatsoever. You see European elites abandoning their own self-interest, their sovereign interests.
Actually, we have to see from the point of view of the European ideologues who wanted always to push for a federal or integrated Europe. Before the crisis in Ukraine, the European project was already in a very bad situation because there is less and less support from the people. Economically, it doesn't work anymore. The euro is a disaster. And the European Union has no voice in the world, although they claim to be geopolitical. Actually, between the US, Russia, China, India, they are weaker and weaker. And this crisis in Ukraine, they have been manipulated. They have been, actually, this one was provoked by a NATO enlargement of a refusal of Washington to negotiate with Russia a new European security treaty arrangement. And the EU and member states, they followed the US. Actually, the governments who are in favor of the EU and integration, like the French, the Germans, they use it in an opportunistic way to save the European project, to find a new enemy, Russia, to push for more European integration, although people are less and less in favor of it. So actually, this EU, this is a sign of vassalization of EU to NATO, and at the same time, it's because internally, we are weaker and more or more divided between member states. That's a reality they try to hide. Russia became the scapegoat of European Union problems.
Yes, and Pierre-Emmanuel, it also gives them reasons to push censorship and deplatforming people, all in the name of national security, of course, here. You know, Pascal, one of the things that we have the 75th anniversary, the official 75th anniversary party of NATO in Washington in July. And they, you know, NATO's good at PR. I mean, that's mostly what they do. But they're facing a catastrophic strategic defeat, and that's something they cannot contemplate. Pascal.
I warn you, though, you know, this is a war that NATO didn't win, which is different from a defeat. I would really not want to see an actual real fight between NATO troops and Russia, which would be way uglier than what we've seen so far. So, yes, NATO will lick its wounds, and NATO and the NATO countries will try to improve their entire industrial chain, because they didn't only lose strategically, they lost the production game of a major war in Europe, and they will try to improve that over time. But they just didn't win Ukraine. I would not want to see them challenged to the point where they would actually go into the field and shift into a different gear, which would be World War III.
Well, I mean, there's one or two ways you can go. There's path A is, as Pascal said, you know, okay, lick your wounds, you didn't win Ukraine, okay? But that's not the lesson learned here. One downside of this is that now NATO certainly has an enemy. Remember, all before this, you know, Russia's an adversary. We're not threatening Russia. This is not about NATO expansion, all their nonsense. That now they can say, oh, we got a real adversary here. What's really interesting, Matthew, is that only 37% of the members of NATO actually spend 2% of their GDP on defense. So, I mean, if Russia is such a huge threat to the European continent, why aren't all the countries spending 110%? Go ahead, Matthew.
No, that's a fun data point. And I was just reading how the U.S. ambassador to NATO was chastising the other non-paying members. As you're correct, if this really was a threat, if this was a serious high priority, you would imagine that much more than the 2% minimum would be spent. We see Russia has spent well over 6% of their GDP on dealing with what they value as a very high priority to deal with the Nazis and the encroaching NATO encirclement of their country. That's what you do when you have a real threat. You spend the appropriate money. And as it turns out, they've wisely been able to solidify a vast amount of positive relationships with Eurasia that has provided a greater hope for real integration of Eurasia and stabilization based on progress of real durable friendships and trust than anything we've ever seen before. So that's good. But no, you're right. There's just no actual follow through. So you could see that people are just being strong armed by a force that must not be spoken about in polite society and public to say certain words, but there's not an ability to actually act and walk the walk, which is just part of this whole, you know, detached technocratic script, which wants to impose their opinions of reality onto the world without actually recognizing that the world isn't that way.
Yeah.
And they're just too used to playing God for too long.
That's why we have this program. We're not polite society, okay?
Right.
Pierre Emmanuel, one of the greatest hopes of the European Union, it was two things, peace and prosperity. Neither are in play right now, meaning Europe is the single biggest loser outside of Ukraine, of course, in this entire ridiculous gambit. Go ahead.
Yes, actually, the problem is European Union is not an autonomous project from Washington. Actually, the European project is a sub-strategy of Washington to control the Rimland, against Russia, because Washington has the strategy of controlling Eurasia with European Rimland on one side and Indo-Pacific on the other side. And European Union, with this crisis, is more and more vassalized by NATO, and it means less security instead of initial project of European project was peace. And they were used as a weapon against Russia, and this is why the project will be more and more in a crisis and have less and less support for the people. And actually, the European Union also is not defending Europe as such, European civilization or European balance of power, which will include, of course, Russia, because Russia is part of European civilization and is a neighbor in Eurasia to Europe. And European Union became more and more a tool to defend a Euro-Atlantic space and I would say, the Western dominance of a world, which is not working anymore in front of the emergence of multipolar world. So they are losing in terms of the system of international relations. And that's why they are so afraid of this conflict.
Well, I think we could just say, thankfully, it's the end of the rules-based order. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Kyoto, Montreal, and here in Moscow. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.